Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Kamala Harris has announced her VP pick, Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota. He's a white guy without a law degree from a quasi-battleground state, a teacher, hunter, and football coach who Democrats hope will appeal to voters in battleground states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and most importantly, Pennsylvania. Republicans plan to paint him as a progressive governor whose policies actually put him to the left of Kamala Harris. But how much impact does a vice president really have on an election? Is this a lot of consternation for a job once described as not being worth a pitcher of warm spit? We're getting the details on Walz this hour and whether vice presidents can swing elections. We begin with reporter Annie Linsky, who covers the White House for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to All Sides, Annie.
Hi, good to be here.
Governor Walz made his national debut yesterday, and my impression is Democrats want to frame him as this folksy Midwestern teacher and football coach with deep blue-collar roots. They're framing him, in my opinion, as the quintessential guy you'd like to have a beer with.
Tim Walz was the kind of teacher and mentor that every child in America dreams of having, and that every kid deserves. The kind of coach, because he's the kind of person who makes people feel like they belong and then inspires them to dream big. And that's the kind of vice president he will be. And that's the kind of vice president America deserves.
Harris really emphasized his blue-collar roots, growing up in small-town Nebraska, being a social studies teacher. How well, at least initially, do you think the campaign has done in giving that folksy Midwestern appearance?
Well, it's good to be here. And look, by all accounts, the Democratic Party has gone from sort of despair to joy in the mind-blowing short period of time. I've covered President Joe Biden for the last 6 years and have really never seen this level of enthusiasm from the Democratic Party, including when I went to Joe Biden's 2020 rallies. I mean, last night you saw people standing in line in 95 degree heat in Philadelphia to get in for to a packed rally. These are things that we have not seen from the Democratic side in quite some time. And so there's a significant amount of enthusiasm to greet this new running mate and also just, you know, support for the top of the ticket. So I think the Walz rollout, as it is, has gone extraordinarily well for the campaign for the first 24 hours. Now, you know, there's a short 90 some odd days left to go, and I'm sure it's just hard to fathom they can keep up this amount of enthusiasm and just momentum, but they certainly have it right now. I mean, I think the other piece of the rollout that I think they are very pleased with is the fact that they managed to keep it secret. You know, I mean, even in this condensed period of time, the news only broke, you know, just sort of a few hours, maybe 2 hours before it was meant to be announced. So I think they feel good about that. And then you had, Governor Walz's speech last night. Amazingly, this is an individual who had never used a teleprompter before. I don't know if you've used a teleprompter before. I have never used one.
I have.
I imagine it's... Oh, you have? Okay.
Yes.
Well, is it difficult to do it the first time around?
Yeah, but I assume he had quite a few rounds of practice throughout the day. It is tricky.
Know. Did he? I mean, there's one day, you know, like a few hours. I mean, maybe he's a quick learner. Maybe that's what he learned.
Yeah. You know, there was also a lot of love espoused for the Pennsylvania governor, Josh Shapiro, last night. But ultimately, Shapiro wasn't the pick. What are you hearing about why Harris chose Walz over Shapiro or Arizona Senator Mark Kelly?
Well, you know, our reporting is that her team felt that any of those three would win with any of those three. So it wasn't like, oh gosh, we need this guy to win or we need this other person to win. And so she could make a personal choice. And, you know, by all accounts, their interview went really well. I think people forget about this. The principal will sit down and have a face-to-face interview, and she did with three of these people, three of these contenders, and that chemistry is important. You are hiring somebody that you cannot fire. If Harris wins, she can fire anybody else, but not the vice president. You can sideline the vice president, you can't fire them. So that seemed to be really significant that they had that chemistry, that they could get along. So, I mean, that seems to be a big part of it. There's also some reporting about, Walz saying that he, or indicating, I should say, and I think we need to be very careful about this, indicating that he's not interested in the top of the ticket, that he wants to be kind of part of the team, support Harris, and does not have greater ambitions. This is something we heard before from a guy named Joe Biden in when Obama picked him. That would be the capstone of his career. So I don't think that we should take that all that seriously. But I think that he's signaling that, look, I'm not using this as a stepping stone. And that seems to be appealing to president or to potential presidents when they're making this selection.
A majority of the country doesn't know Tim Walz yet. I believe NPR's polling put it at 70% don't really know who he is. So this is going to be his introduction to the country. Republicans, at least initially, plan to zero in on the violence in Minneapolis following George Floyd's murder in Memorial Day weekend in 2020. How important do you think it's going to be for Walz to have a good answer on this attack?
Yeah, look, Walz is going to have to answer for that and then other policies that he signed into law in Minnesota that Republicans will paint as far left and are indeed left of center. But he's done it before. He has been on TV. He does have answers for the way that he has governed, for the sort of suite of liberal policies that he signed into law in Minnesota. And he and the Harris team likes his answer. I mean, he's out there saying that, look, he wants he, the way he said it, and this is going to be replayed quite a lot, is that he sees sort of socialism as being a good neighbor. I don't know how that plays in the rest of the country, but he's saying that the policies that he has supported are to help people and to make people's lives easier, and that he's fine being associated with policies that make people's lives easier. I will say one of the really interesting things about politics right now is there is a realignment to where there are sections of the Republican Party, and certainly they don't call it socialism, but are supporting the types of policies that used to be the sort of the purview of the far left. These include issues along the lines of a child tax credit. You saw former President Trump, even just today, this morning on Fox and Friends, saying that he believes that seniors should not be taxed, that tips and wages should not be taxed. So there's a similar core of voters that both sides are aiming for. And some of those policies have, not in rhetoric, but in fact, a little bit of overlap. So yes, the Republicans are already painting Harris as a far left. They call her a San Francisco liberal, and they are going to certainly use the policies that Walz has signed into law to amplify that characterization. I will say the texts that I was getting last night from a number of people as Walz was speaking was that, like, my gosh, he really reads like a Republican. That he when I say reads, he kind of comes across as a Republican. And often people don't get into the policies. They just sort of get into the vibes. And that's the vibe that at least he seemed to be portraying last night. Of course, Republicans are going to drop hundreds of millions of dollars in ads painting him and Harris as someone else. And that is what they do. That's what campaigns are about. Of course, Democrats are going to do the same and are already doing the same to paint Republicans as extremists.
Yeah, Democrats have tried to define the Republican vice presidential pick, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, as a guy who doesn't like people who aren't parents and a guy who doesn't like cats. What I found fascinating of the rollout of Walz, considering most of the country doesn't know him, is that the Harris campaign posted a photo montage of Walz with his cat yesterday afternoon and this audio.
My God, they went after cat people. Good luck with that. Turn on the internet and see what cat people do when you go after them. These people, they, if it would be funny if it wasn't so sad.
I feel like they're really making a play for younger voters here. Particularly, I mean, if you look at Kamala HQ on TikTok, they are very social media savvy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a strong, there was a lot of trolling last night. Waltz also made a comment about wanting to debate J.D. Vance if only he would, you know, quote unquote, get off the couch. You know, this was a reference to, you know, what I believe, and we tend not to use our own opinions here, but I will say this, I believe a very unfair kind of internet joke about J.D. Vance that was rooted in inaccuracy, that he had said something about having a very close relations with his couch in his book.
Yeah, it's a piece of misinformation that's out there about what's in Hillbilly Elegy.
And it was completely wrong.
Right.
Right. It was completely wrong. And the internet kind of grabbed onto it to suggest that there was something to it. There is not. But I think it's very unfair. And Waltz did make a reference to that joke in his speech last night. You know, I do think Democrats really need to be careful with that kind of thing. In fact, anybody ought to be careful about that. If the internet can create some giant lie about one person, they can certainly create a giant lie about another. And I just think you don't want to be fanning that no matter what. So even if it's, you know, your opponent who's being attacked, it's the type of thing that I think, you know, I think
cuts both ways.
It's unfair.
Yeah, Waltz.
Right. I don't think you can on one side be the party of. I think that is a very dangerous game for either party to be playing.
Waltz is also the creator of the new catchphrase for Democrats that Trump is weird. Waltz used the word weird on NBC's Morning Joe just a couple weeks ago. It's crazy how quick this is all happening, but it's become a real catchphrase for the Democrats. Republicans are weird. And it appears to be sticking to Trump in ways that other criticisms of him just haven't.
It was fascinating. Waltz went on to Morning Joe, which is, you know, Joe Biden's favorite show, and he made that comment, Republicans are weird. And within a week you had Vice President Harris also referencing it. So it's something that Democrats really liked. They liked it, and it did catch on. Part of the appeal appears to be that it isn't as sort of kind of doom and gloomy as some of the rhetoric that was coming from the Biden campaign. It's a little bit more sort of dismissive than sort of so kind of dark and horrible, which is sort of the words that were kind of the rhetoric that was coming out of the Biden campaign when they were talking about Trump. And this is a little bit lighter and a little more dismissive, and I think seems to work a little bit better. At least the Democrats feel that way. And it is, you're right, it is sticking in a way that some of the other rhetoric just kind of felt heavy and didn't have the same resonance.
I will say my favorite take on the pick so far is the grammatical one. There was a tweet shared that with Harris and Walls at the top of the ticket, we're about to enter apostrophe hell. And I do appreciate that because it is one of those confusing, do you put the apostrophe in for S's and Z's? But, you know.
Yes. Well, I mean, fortunately, you're on radio. As a print reporter, I do have to struggle with that. And often different outlets have different style rules. I will tell you, at the Wall Street Journal, we got a note. It's Z apostrophe S and Harris is S apostrophe S.
Well, good to know. Yeah, I spent the first 12 years of my career as a print reporter, so I feel your pain on that one. But, you know, one of the biggest questions is how much of an impact vice presidential picks are going to have in any election or specifically this one. And we're definitely going to dive into that more as the hour unfolds. But in a year that's been so unprecedented, I feel hesitant to say whether it matters or not.
I mean, I think it matters. I think all of these events matter. I remember, I mean, golly, just a few short weeks ago, talking to somebody about whether debates matter. Well, guess what? They really do matter. This is the biggest decision that Kamala Harris has made so far and really will make in her campaign. She is signaling a lot about how she wants to govern, who she wants to be surrounded by, As Elizabeth Warren has long said, personnel is policy, and this is the first person that she has chosen, and this is again a person who cannot be fired. Do vice presidents matter? I absolutely they do, and there is evidence for it. You look at 2016 when Donald Trump chose Mike Pence. That was a sign to the religious right that Donald Trump was truly on board with their agenda, and it turned out to be something that they grabbed onto. They agreed. They helped put him in the White House, and then he did govern the way that he said he would. So I think that this notion, again, you look at Barack Obama. He chose Joe Biden. That was also a choice that mattered, that made some white voters feel more comfortable with a black president. It's unfortunate that that would have to be the case, but that was the sort of reality that his team was considering. And also Biden's ex foreign policy experience made people feel more comfortable that this young and unexperienced on foreign policy nominee would have some foreign policy heft ne right next to him. So I think it can be fashionable to say that parts of campaigns don't matter, do conventions matter, do debates matter, does the vice president matter? And I will tell your listeners, 100% they matter.
Yeah, on the flip side of that, John McCain famously chose Sarah
Yes.
Palin, and there's been a lot of debate about whether that cost him the election.
Yes, absolutely right. Absolutely right.
That was Annie Linsky, a White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking to the author of two books on vice presidential picks and whether they're going to matter to voters. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. The names at the top of the Democratic and Republican ticket are set for November. Vice President Kamala Harris chose Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to be her running mate, while former President Donald Trump selected Ohio's own Senator J.D. Vance. Conventional political wisdom says that VP picks can help on the margins, but they don't swing an entire election. But 2024 has been anything but conventional. Joining me now is University of Dayton political science professor Christopher Devine. He's written two books on vice presidents, Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections, and The VP Advantage, How Running Mates Influence Home State Voting in Presidential Elections. Welcome to All Sides, Chris.
Anna, thank you for having me. I'm a big All Sides fan, so this is fun.
Oh, cool. Happy to have you. So let's start with this question of whether running mates matter. Here is former President Donald Trump from his recent appearance at the National Association of Black Journalists Conference.
But I will say this, and I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president in terms of the election does not have any impact. I mean, virtually no impact. You have two or three days where there's a lot of commotion as to who, like you're having it on the Democrat side, who it's going to be. And then that dies down, and it's all about the presidential pick.
Is he right? Is that a fair assessment of the role of the vice president?
That's a really interesting comment to hear, of course. That my temptation is to think he read our book. This is my book with Kyle Kopko, Do Running Mates Matter? By the way, we started that our research on VPs while grad students at Ohio State. So shout out to Ohio State. I think Trump's comment is more right than wrong. He's closer to the truth than he is farther from it. It really, the more dangerous exaggeration, I think, is when people act as if the VP choice is going to determine the outcome of the election, that everything hinges on this. It's a game changer. John McCain thought this in 2008. That's why he overreached and picked Sarah Palin, which we show is an unwise move. So, you know, it's easier to overstate their impact. Now, I will quibble with something that Trump said about them having no impact. I think it's true based on our research, and he said this as he elaborated on the comments more, that people vote for the top of the ticket. They're voting based on a presidential candidate. And folks, think of it this way. If you prefer, Donald Trump to Kamala Harris, but she picks the VP that you, and I'd just love to see that person as the vice president of the United States. You're going to switch your vote? I mean, do we really think people do that? So I think that's always been exaggerated, and we show that. But where they matter, and it's on the margins, where they matter is in terms of what we call an indirect effect. That is the choice of a running mate. Contrary to what Trump's saying, no impact. No, it's not true. They do impact how we look at the presidential candidate. They could shift our perceptions of their ideology. They could influence how we think about their judgment. So if you make a really responsible pick, and as what I'm sure we'll talk about, I think Tim Walz was absolutely credible as a VP. Whatever you think of his politics, he's qualified for the job. That's probably going to boost Kamala Harris somewhat. If she had instead chosen someone who was not clearly up to the job and maybe was just chasing after some votes in a swing state, I think voters would have seen right through that and thought less of her as a potential leader. It's basically a statement about, look, are you making important decisions in the long-term interest of the country or in the short-term interest of you politically?
Speaking of being qualified on day one, that was the actual question that Trump got about Vance at that conference. He doesn't actually answer whether he thinks Vance would be qualified on day one in that particular clip, but it is the essence of the job as vice president. Essentially, they're the backup quarterback, the person ready to take over in the middle of the game. And it's not like it never happens. I did a little data mining of my own, and 4 U.S. presidents have been assassinated, another 4 have died in office, and 1 very famously resigned. So that means about 20% of America's vice presidents have actually had to step up to the plate, not to beat the sports metaphors to death here.
I'll give you another one. It's always been true, constitutionally speaking, that the vice president is the backup quarterback. They take over, something happens to the president. But that language was written and ratified and put into practice at a time when, you know, VPs didn't do much. Constitutionally, they have very little power. What's happened informally over the last 50 years or so, okay, this was no change in the Constitution, no change in the law. It's just a change in practice. Any president could do it differently. Donald Trump did it a little differently. But for about the past 50 years, since Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale were in the White House, the vice president has taken on a lot of informal power. They've essentially become the top advisor to the president. And often the last person in the room is how it's described. Look, when they're making an important foreign policy decision, that might be the last person the president talks to, gives them a lot of influence. So in fact, the sports analogy here might less be the backup quarterback than the assistant coach, or I'm a baseball fan, the bench coach, you know, talking over the big decisions before they're actually made. It's a very important position, but mostly for the things they don't formally do and for a lot of things that we don't actually see.
Kamala Harris, though, famously was the tiebreaker in the U.S. Senate repeatedly. So that is another job that they have. You don't often see them exercise it as much as she did, but it is a thing that they do.
Right. And that's a response to the circumstances. She set the record for the most tiebreaking votes in the Senate. But that's largely just because the Senate is so evenly divided and she served for that period of time.
So there was a lot of discussion surrounding both Trump and Harris's picks. And I want to unpack a little bit of how they're rolling out. So, I mean, Tim Walz is very new. We're still rolling him out. But I want to talk about how J.D. Vance has rolled out, because arguably it's been a bumpy start to their campaign. His unfavorables have skyrocketed in the last 2 weeks.
Right. And it points to what I think is a critical thing to realize about VP picks. And it's absolutely true for Tim Walz. Okay. They are not well known usually when they're introduced, unless you're picking a presidential rival. Think of, for example, of course, JFK and LBJ is a famous one. But what about 2004 when John Kerry picked John Edwards, who, though a freshman senator, and by the way, I don't think the best pick in terms of experience, and we saw a little more of him later on why he was a bad pick. But Edwards had run a competitive campaign against Kerry for the nomination. Now, when you pick someone like that who's well-known, they're better defined. They've already had a chance to tell people who they are. then they just have to adjust to being on the ticket and maybe moving some of their positions. J.D. Vance is a great example of how we can't assume that folks that haven't run a national race are well-known. J.D. Vance, who is famous for writing this best-selling book in 2016, Hillbilly Elegy, is made into a movie. I mean, you'd think this guy is known by Americans, you know, vast majority, right? He was at about 50%. Some Bloomberg polls, swing state polls, had showed this back in May. Only about half of people knew who he was. And that's actually typical. If you look back, for example, at 2016, right after Mike Pence and Tim Kaine were introduced as the VP nominees, you know, there's some polling asking about, well, you have a favorable, unfavorable opinion. Remember, this is not before the pick. This is just after the big announcement, okay, and the rollout and all that stuff. About 60% of people, actually 61% in both cases, could not state an opinion on them either way. And so what I'm getting at is that, you know, with J.D. Vance's introduction, now with Tim Walz, Americans are figuring out who these people are. I think Republicans missed an opportunity. They missed a window to define who J.D. Vance was. They let Democrats define him more. By the way, some of it was through videos and statements that he had put out while he ran for the Senate here in Ohio. They should have known that in the vet. They should have been absolutely ready to go in defending those comments, or if they couldn't defend them, then don't pick him. Okay, they didn't seem ready for that. So I think they botched the rollout. Now, Tim Walz, there's no guarantee he's going to have a good rollout. This is a critical time for Democrats to tell the American people who don't know who Tim Walz is, to tell them who he is, to define him in a simple narrative. You can't tell them everything all at once. Give a clear message of who this guy is and why he should be vice president, or else Republicans are going to do that.
Yeah, I think the way I see it is Democrats want to define, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is my initial impression. So Democrats want to define Walz as like a small town guy you'd like to have a beer with. He doesn't have a law degree. He was a high school social studies teacher. He was a football coach. He hunts. He likes to go to the state fair and like tease his daughter. Like, they really want that folksy Midwestern charm. He looks, the guy who looks like who speaks like a Republican but passes policies like a progressive. On the flip side, I think Republicans want to paint him as even further left than Kamala Harris. And I'm going to be really curious to see which version of Walz sticks.
I think you're right. I'll pick up on the Republican point first, maybe come back to the Democratic one. Republicans absolutely, in my opinion, should focus on ideology. In fact, I think the real squandered opportunity here over the last couple of weeks as Kamala Harris has emerged as a presidential nominee is that Republicans have had this kind of stop and start approach to defining her, mostly because Donald Trump just can't stay on message. You saw that interview that we were referencing earlier. He was just all over the place. He needs to focus on Kamala. There's a lot to work with. She was rated one of the most liberal senators. She went further to the left heading into the 2020 primaries. You know, of course, those aren't entirely her positions now, and so she's trying to reposition. But that's an opportunity they can exploit to say, hey, look, whatever you think of Donald Trump, this other person is too extreme. With Tim Walz, she chose a fellow progressive. She had some moderate options. Again, our research shows that actually choosing, in this case, a more moderate VP could have shifted perceptions of her towards the center. I don't think Tim Walz is further to her left. He just kind of confirms, you know, more or less where she is. She's not certainly the furthest left Bernie Sanders, but you know, she's well to the left of the party, or maybe sort of towards the middle, maybe, you know, a little left of Joe Biden, let's say. So that seems to confirm it. Republicans, I think, have an opportunity there, and they have to at least choose one message. They can't keep trying to say, you know, seven different things at once. I'll go quickly to the point you made about how Democrats are portraying him. You're right. They're portraying him as kind of Midwestern dad and all that kind of stuff. You know, and there's a certain appeal to that. It's a really interesting approach and kind of seems to fit who Walz is. I will say this, though. I'm skeptical how much that kind of disliking Tim Walz is going to move votes. Again, in our research, we test some of this out. What about the popularity or unpopularity of a VP candidate? How much does that move voters? Really not much. Again, people are mostly voting for a president, not a vice president. So it's more, what can this person tell me about who Kamala Harris is? And I think they'd be wise to focus on his experience, especially contrasted with J.D. Vance, who is holding his first political office. He's run one race in his entire life, a very competitive race, impressive that he won. But he was sworn to the Senate early last year. Kamala Harris over one-term governor Josh Shapiro, who has no foreign policy experience, for instance. People think that was a mistake. I don't, because Tim Walz can speak to a wider range of experience. He's not only been a governor, a two-term governor, but he's served in Congress, has foreign policy experience, plus a quarter century as serving in the military. So I think they should talk a little more about his experience, why he's qualified, and draw a contrast to J.D. Vance.
They both Vance and Walz have military experience. And I kind of wonder if there was some calculus there that, okay, you've got one veteran against another veteran.
Yeah, that's interesting. And there's been, you know, in the kind of VP audition stage, there was a lot of talk about, well, how would this person match up with J.D. Vance? You know, Andy Beshear was trying to, you know, be the one who would challenge Vance's credentials as a, you know, Kentuckian or coming from Appalachia. You know, I'm skeptical that voters do that kind of side by side. It's really interesting, you know, for anyone who's very focused on the campaign to think about that contrast. But really, the only opportunity that voters have to do that is at the VP debate. And it gets a lot of hype. It's funny, I was recently looking back on some stuff from 2020, and I forgot people said that this was the most important VP debate of our lifetime, and it was going to change everything. Looking back on it now, what do we remember it for? A fly landing on Mike Pence's head. You know, did that end up changing the election? I don't think so. So it's not unimportant. It's just, I always like to think of it this way. In an election, a presidential election, there are a million and one things to consider. There are so many things that we could factor into our vote. And so in the end, for it to come down to how Tim Walz compares to J.D. Vance or vice versa, you know, it's not unimportant. I just don't think that's what people will vote on. It's, again, what's the VP telling us about the presidential candidate? What is choosing a person with very little experience in J.D. Vance tell us about Donald Trump? What is choosing someone with much more experience tell us about Kamala Harris? What about their ideology and so on? That could tell us pro or con why that person might deserve to be president or not.
I was listening to the 538 Politics podcast, and Galen Druk described it as being a vibes election versus a policy election. And that if it's about vibes, he thinks Harris is going to win. But if it becomes about policy, he thinks Trump is going to win. And I thought that was a really interesting way to frame it.
It is. And you know, politics about all these things, right? So it maybe is who gets a better message across. And I will say, let's remember the context here. The Biden administration is unpopular. Yeah. As I understand it, his numbers have actually gone up a good bit since he withdrew from the race. I do think it's hard to tell how much that feeling about the Biden administration was always about policy, which obviously people are upset about inflation. The Afghanistan withdrawal was a mess. And there are plenty of things that one could criticize. There are also things that one could praise. But, you know, I think he was always weighed down by age and who knows how much that mattered. But anyway, Kamala Harris is running as the incumbent VP of an unpopular administration. She could change that. I don't know, but probably not dramatically. She's trying to get people focused on something different, to focus on what a future administration for her could look like, to talk about what's wrong with Donald Trump, in her opinion. So, you know, if those vibes are working in her favor, yeah, you want to shift it that way. There are some policies that will be strong for either side. But the bottom line context here is we have an incumbent VP of an unpopular administration. Again, the more the Trump campaign can actually focus on policy, be consistent in their message, stop getting distracted, they'll have a better job. But with a guy at the top of the ticket who just can't seem to stay on message, I don't know if that's possible.
I was sort of stunned at the National Association of Black Journalists when Trump got into this question of whether Kamala Harris is black. And I was like, oh. Like, objectively, regardless of what you think of his argument, I was like, I don't know. Like, was that was... It just fundamentally felt like the wrong political move, regardless of what conclusions you want to draw about the appropriateness of those kinds of insinuations.
It was a bizarre, I don't even know what to say, it was a bizarre and ridiculous statement. And I think what it's actually telling in terms of strategy, Anna, you know, and talking about messaging, this part of what I'm referring to, is there was a possibility that somehow they could just put that aside and I don't know, just move on. Instead, what do they do? And this is, you know, just what we've seen from Donald Trump even before he got into politics, the strategy is just double down, triple down, quadruple down. You know, so they have the rally that night and put it up on the screen, headlines, you know, misleading headlines that we don't even need to dissect, that to say that she actually was solely claiming to be Asian American and so on. You know, just let it go. But instead, They keep going back to it. They let the story be about that, the news cycle be about that. Focus on policy. That's where you have a chance to defeat Kamala Harris, and they still could. Absolutely. This is a close race. I think it could go either way. It's looking good for Kamala Harris, but the fundamentals in some way, well, it's hard to tell exactly, but there are fundamentals to work with on Donald Trump's side. But focusing on things like that, or I guess getting distracted by things like that, is absolutely the wrong move. And the fact that, by the way, J.D. Vance, backs Trump up on that narrative rather than, again, moving on, tells you a lot about how when Trump meanders in some other direction, it's like everybody else has to follow. They're squandering opportunities.
That's University of Dayton political science professor Christopher Devine. Coming up, is it better to pick a VP for their swing state success or their crossover appeal? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about vice presidents this hour and whether they matter when it comes time to vote. Still with us is University of Dayton political science professor Christopher Devine, the author of not one, but two books about the vice presidency. So, Christopher, Vox had an article titled, "Will Kamala Harris Regret Picking Tim Walz Over Josh Shapiro?" You called it the best VP analysis you will read all day, and it breaks down the case for and against picking Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. One argument is that the road to the White House runs through Pennsylvania, where Harris is not ahead of Donald Trump, at least not right now.
Right. Yeah, this goes to the expectation of a home state advantage. And honestly, this is where my work with Kyle Kopko started all those years ago back at Ohio State, is in actually the 08 selection process, hearing people just take for granted that what a dumb move, Sarah Palin, why not pick Rob Portman? Of course you'd pick up Ohio. Ohio voters, would that have changed? Would you have voted for John McCain over Barack Obama if you voted for that way? Would you have changed because of Rob Portman? I think it goes to what happens when you get a little too in the weeds of politics and everything becomes a game and a strategy session, rather than thinking about how you or the people surrounding you vote, thinking that they're so easily manipulated. Look, I'm not saying that the home state advantage definitively doesn't exist. We'll never know whether Josh Shapiro could have delivered the state of Pennsylvania. But as a political scientist, all I can tell you is we've tested the conventional wisdom, seven ways from Sunday here, and we have found that there's just not clear evidence of this. Even Tim Kaine in Virginia, who in 2016, I know we don't think of it as that much of a swing state, but it kind of was then. And we look at whether he moved votes there, and there's just no evidence of this. So let me put it this way. If Josh Shapiro were the governor of New Jersey, I don't think he would have been in the conversation. He was in the conversation, and that's not a criticism of him. I mean, we might very well see him as a presidential candidate in the future. He's got a lot of talent and a record that seems to be impressing his home state voters. But he's a first-term governor. Again, he has no foreign policy experience. There are a lot of limitations there that Tim Walz does make up for, okay? And if the reason to pick him, again, he's not the governor of Jersey, he's Pennsylvania, so he's at the top of the conversation. If the reason to pick him, the decisive influence that he comes from Pennsylvania, which probably is the most important swing state, that's true, you're resting everything on an expectation of advantage that is just not well documented. I think actually what impresses voters more, and actually this is not just opinion, again, this goes back to the actual evidence that we show over multiple elections. We show it in 2020, for example. What impresses voters the most is picking a VP who is clearly up to the job. I'm not saying Josh Shapiro isn't, I'm just saying Tim Walz more clearly is. Of being vice president, even president, on day one, next year, early next year. No on-the-job training, or very, very little at least, okay? That's what impresses voters the most. And that's what helps them to think of, in this case, Kamala Harris as a potential leader. There are other things that go into this process too. I mean, frankly, I just think it's ridiculous. Some of the coverage that we're hearing today, that there are people who with absolutely no knowledge of the process are convinced that they know the one reason why Josh Shapiro wasn't selected. In this case, his stance on Israel in combination with him being Jewish, that it was anti-Semitism or some kind of opinion on the Gaza war. Look, I don't know. Maybe we'll find out eventually it was. I'm not saying it wasn't. I doubt that that's all it was. But we don't know. And some things come down to chemistry, the job interview. And from what we're hearing early on here, Walz just had an incredible interview. By the way, he apparently said that he does not want to run for president. That could be reassuring for a president to know that the VP is not somehow angling for the job or is not going to undercut them at some point. Josh Shapiro, this is no criticism of his, but he seems very interested in that in the future and apparently didn't have a great interview. So there are so many factors that go into it. He should not have been chosen simply to pick up Pennsylvania. The fact that he wasn't chosen might suggest they don't believe in that advantage. I think that would be smart on their part, or at least not enough to pick him on that basis. But there are so many other factors, and we just don't know what we don't know. We'll find out some more later.
But I will say, if Harris loses Pennsylvania, a lot of people are going to Monday mortar quarterback about whether Shapiro would have carried it.
That's right. That's right. And I'm going to spin this into a baseball analogy, because I think of when the manager does not bring in the closer at a certain point, when that's the conventional move to make, and maybe goes with the more reliable setup guy in a certain situation. I'll stop with that. But, you know, it's so much easier to make the move that is utterly conventional, because then if you lose, you can just say, I was following the script. You know, you can't blame me for doing what you're supposed to do in that situation. It takes some courage to go outside of that. And, you know, I frankly, I'm impressed that the Harris team did not rest everything on this presumption of a home state advantage and make this important pick based solely on that one thing. And I think one factor here has to be that Kamala Harris is a vice president. She knows how important that is. And if she didn't have the best relationship and, you know, there just wasn't the right chemistry, or she just wasn't totally sure of Josh Shapiro as a number two in the administration, for her to sit alongside him for 4 or 8 years as the last person in the room and all of that, knowing this wasn't my first choice, but, you know, he delivered Pennsylvania or actually we didn't even need it. You know, I think that would have been a hard thing to swallow. It seems like Harris really has a great relationship so far with Tim Walz and has confidence that he'd be a better vice president. Frankly, I think that voters in comparing the two will think that Walz is the better potential vice president, at least based on his resume. And there are other considerations.
Oh, yeah.
Again, every candidate has pros and cons, so I don't want to say it was a slam dunk.
Yeah, I mean, I always like to joke, Paul Ryan did not give Mitt Romney his home state of Wisconsin in 2012. Now, Ryan was a congressman. He had never actually won statewide in Wisconsin, so not exactly apples to apples. Although I will say my favorite factoid is that in the 1980 presidential election, Jimmy Carter lost every state except the home state of his vice president, Minnesota native Walter Mondale.
I think it was 84. Mondale won as a presidential candidate. So Carter had a couple other states in 80, but he did win Minnesota, because I think I could be wrong. I think a lot of them were Southern or New England states in 80, but Minnesota stood out. So, yeah, it's possible. We cannot say definitively that there's never been a home state advantage that it wouldn't happen this time. But I think the right way to be thinking about this, folks, especially if you're thinking that it really should have been Shapiro, is, are you so confident in that empirical fact that there is a home state advantage that you would rest the entire choice on that one thing? And I just think that would be a mistake.
So I want to ask you about the vice presidential debate, because, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago, we might have had a conversation about whether debates matter. We're pretty certain at this point in this election that the debates do have an impact. Do you think we're going to see a VP debate, and how do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, so from a political science standpoint, I have to say, as far as debates, it's one of these things where they don't matter within normal parameters. It's when someone just, I don't know how to say it, but just dramatically underperforms, as we saw with Joe Biden, just absolutely disastrous debate performance on June 27th. Sure, that can matter. But under any normal circumstances, it doesn't move things much because, you know, even if you have a rough debate like Barack Obama had the first time out in 2012, you get some other chances. So maybe in the last debate, a disaster that could have more of an effect. But, you know, for this time around, I mean, we'll see what the debate schedule ends up being, right? There's some contestation over that. You know, I think this will be an interesting VP debate. J.D. Vance, as we saw here in Ohio, has been through a few debates himself. In the Republican primary, and then against Tim Ryan in the general election. Tim Walz, of course, having run for office many times, has experience. I'd seen one comment. It's just, I guess, secondhand through media reports, but I guess Walz says he's not much of a debater. You know,
lowering
we'll see,
expectations.
Already, he's getting on it very early, huh?
I don't think that Walz, though, at least I don't get the impression that he's going to subscribe to the when they go low, we go high. Like, if his opening speech was any indication, like, what I find really fascinating is Harris and Walz seem far more comfortable getting down in the mud with Donald Trump than previous opponents of his.
That's right. By the way, I thought it was encouraging. Apparently, J.D. Vance, you know, you may have seen had called Walz after he was selected and congratulated him. I think that's
that felt
really
pretty
great
normal.
To see. Yeah. Last I heard, Walz hadn't called back, but I'm not sure that that's still true. He certainly should. So I think you know, it's often expected of the VP candidate they'll be the attack dog. That's a traditional role because in normal elections, long ago in a land far away, presidential candidates tried to stay dignified and the VP could roll around in the mud, make the charges the presidential candidate didn't want to have their fingerprints on, right? At least in this context, you can't do it that way. Donald Trump is his own attack dog. Like it or not, I think that's always been one of his strengths as a candidate. It's at least something that people who like him seem to gravitate toward, is that he will, you know, absolutely go after the other side and you know, be as hard on them as possible. So Kamala Harris doesn't have the luxury of staying positive, if any presidential candidate actually does. She has to do that too. She has to, in some ways, be her own attack dog. But Tim Walz clearly is happy in that role as well. And I think that's one of the ways he distinguished himself in this audition process, which, frankly, I think is one of the most impressive audition processes we've ever had for VP. He went from, you know, barely registering as a potential VP to being right at the top of the list. And it's, you know, how he came out with the weird comment, which took off. Other things he said that I think showed that he could keep up strong messaging from the campaign side. And by the way, as vice president, you still have to communicate with the American public, be persuasive in public comments as well as in private interactions when you're the president, vice president of the United States. So that might have been compelling. You know, what strikes me about Walz as an attack dog is that he does a lot of this with a smile on his face. He seems to be kind of the happy warrior type. Now, I'm not saying that folks should love and embrace it. You might still think that Walz is being too negative, and we'll see how he conducts himself during the campaign. But there's a way of being negative that doesn't necessarily sound nasty. Some people just sound mean-spirited when they do it. Some people can do it with a smile on their face, and it might go over better.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that Midwestern politeness about him, but I think it is sprinkled a little bit with that, like, Southern, like, you say something that sounds nice, but it's really actually pretty mean. That, like, oh, bless your heart type of insult.
Yeah, Minnesota nice might get a new spin here. I don't know. We're going to have to, there's going to be a new term that comes out of this. I'm not sure what it is yet. Maybe we can coin it today.
Yeah, I don't know. But I do think he does. He has that very happy-go-lucky sound to his voice when he's saying some pretty insulting things. Like, he was giggling as he made a reference to J.D. Vance in a couch. He was giggling while calling. Like, he was like, and that doesn't count the crimes Trump has committed. Like, he had really harsh words for his opponents, but he came off as, like, a really happy-go-lucky guy, which I found a very interesting sort of, almost like they feel like mutually exclusive things, but like blending that is it's difficult.
Yeah, he that was, I think, probably the most, you know, viral moment of the the rally yesterday was him saying that he'd love to debate J.D. Vance if he could get off his couch. And then he said, see what I did there. So kind of what you're speaking to, you know, which, by the way, I have to say, since the couch thing is completely made up, I don't think that's something that any candidate should be recirculating in any way. So yeah. I think that was frankly shameful on his part to do so, even if it was an effective joke for the moment. But it was interesting to see Kamala Harris behind him.
Oh, she was trying to hold it in. Yeah, you could tell. She's like, do I laugh? Do I not laugh?
Exactly. I know. And she's got a lot of practice from being the VP sitting behind the president of the State of the Union address about, you know, facial expressions and who's going to notice. But she seemed not quite sure what to do about that. And it does make me wonder if Walz has a little Joe Biden in him as a vice presidential candidate. I haven't seen him have just a flat out gaffe that and I'm sure there's video out there. It's probably something I haven't seen yet. at him as a candidate, maybe he's going to shoot his mouth off sometime and get himself in trouble. That's the chance you take. If you want someone who's never going to have that kind of moment, you choose someone really bland. I don't know. I guess it sounds harsh to say, but Andy Beshear comes to mind as someone who probably would not have had those moments. But then you lose a little of the personality, the color. So, hey, everybody's strengths can be their weaknesses too. We'll see how it plays out for Tim Walz.
That was University of Dayton political science professor Christopher Devine. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Anna. This was fun.
His books, Do Running Mates Matter? And The VP Advantage, are both out, and you can find them anywhere books are sold. Thank you all so much for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.